This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
Our guest this hour is a guy that I've been looking forward to having on the show for quite some time. His name is Ron Grissom. He is a Greenville resident, originally from Ramsey, where I grew up. But like me, Ramsey sent us a lot of different places way far away. And by golly, it's nice to have you here, Ron. Let's talk a little basketball. And thank you for coming. You have been a basketball referee from literally the early, well, let's see. I want to go back to, I don't want to say how far back it was, but we started out talking about high school and wound up doing Big Ten and Big Eight and a lot of NCAA tournaments. It is fascinating to talk about refereeing at that level. Give me an idea of how you got started and how you became a referee.
Well, I took an elective when I was a student at EIU at Charleston, Illinois, under Dr. Maynard O'Brien, and it was a basketball officiating class. And after completing that, he would then assign us intramural basketball games that were going on to officiate them, and we got paid a major salary of $1 a game.
Dollar a game. Well, you did well. That's Dr. O'Brien's football field named after him.
And he was the football coach then, and a big, gruff man that was a teddy bear.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
He was a nice guy.
Probably didn't let you find that out immediately, though, did he?
No, I was always afraid of it.
So, from a dollar a game doing intramural games, after you left EIU, I'm assuming there was a teaching career involved in there somewhere.
There was. I graduated from EIU and was hired the summer of, I graduated in the spring, was hired during that summer at Bond County Unit 2 High School at Greenville, Illinois.
What'd you teach?
Taught business education, typing, bookkeeping, business math, and that was the main subject. Mostly it was typing classes because we put every kid through typing as a sophomore or junior.
Don't you wish they still taught that?
Yeah, I know I couldn't teach keyboarding.
It's amazing. But the greatest thing that I ever did in high school was take a typing class. And at Ramsey it was an elective. And I'm sure glad I did, because people I know who hunt and peck, they're miserable.
Yes, they are.
I don't mean miserable people. They're miserable when they're hunting and pecking, you know. But, yeah, keyboarding is a great thing. So you taught, and somehow or another, some point along the line, you got into refereeing, had the bug or whatever from the intramural games. How did doing it professionally come about?
Mr. Shea was Paul Shea was the athletic director at the high school, and he was always needing referees for his JV games. He could get the varsity people, but they would come out of Granite City area, the east side. But for the most part, he needed JV officials. So I told him, I said, well, I'm registered, so I'll be guided to work for you. So from that, the teams that came into play, then they would hire me. And so I got to working for JV games for all the teams around in our conference. And it was, I was satisfied with that. I like to work my JV game and then get a free bag of popcorn and a soda and that the athletic director would give me at the end of the game, and also get paid a little bit of money. And then I'd go up and watch the varsity officials work, and I learned an awfully lot watching those people work.
Now, when you started, and say we're looking here in the early 60s, mid 60s, what did a JV referee get for a night?
I think we got
$7.50. Okay. No. Anything for expenses, travel?
No.
That was it?
No.
Gas was about 33 cents a gallon?
Probably right around that.
Yeah. Okay. So then you get into the mid-state, and then you go into some of the larger high schools. How did that come about?
Well, I received assignments to work the varsity games for a while on the east side, was assigned, I guess the east side officials probably saw me work JV games because they would always come early, and they started giving me a recommendation on the east side, and the east side meaning Belleville East, Belleville West, Collinsville, that sort of thing. And pretty soon I was getting offers to work those varsity games in that area. So that's how the varsity came about.
Now, the money got a little bit better, I guess, down there.
Money was about twice as much.
Okay.
And from that point on, through the high school officiating, you're first registered, then recognized, and then certified. Those are the three levels, or at least they were when I was doing that. And so I kept taking the test to get to the certification, which meant then I could work state-sponsored tournaments, meaning the regionals, the districts, the regionals, the sectionals, and so forth. But and so I started getting... worked a couple of districts, and then I got some regionals, and from that point on, it went on up to the sectionals and the super sectionals.
Now,
and
just,
the state finals.
Just whenever you sent me some information ahead of time so I could ask you questions that meant something and I didn't sound stupid, it says you've worked 21 regionals. That's 21 years worth of regionals,
that's
right?
Correct.
You couldn't work two in 1 year, not if you're working boys, and we didn't have girls at that time.
Right.
12 sectionals, so you did a lot of sectionals after the regionals those years, 8 super sectionals, and I would be in trouble if I didn't have you talk about this, because our good friend Terry Tote, our operations manager and the guy who's on the air right before me, always talks to me about the Lincolnwood team of 1972 that went to the state tournament, and you worked the super sectional game at Decatur Milliken that year.
That's correct.
Do you remember anything about that team at all?
I remember that a guy from Peoria, an official from Peoria, was sent to work with me, and I had never seen or heard of him. And he had never seen or heard from me. And his name was Bingo Krotz.
Okay.
And Bingo was a good feeler, just a happy-go-lucky guy, and from the big city is really what he was, and I was just a small town guy. But we got along well, and it was really a great game, and I was, as far as I was concerned, I don't know who the losing team was. That was a team from nearer the Indiana line.
Okay. It might have been. Terry, I know Terry's probably listening. He may text me and tell me who it was they beat.
But anyway, Raymond Lincolnwood won, I think, fairly easily, but I don't know. I don't know.
They had an excellent team. Yeah. They had an excellent team then. Of course, then they went back to the state tournament a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you work, as we say, you start out doing intramural games at Eastern. We wind up doing super sectionals and 3 state tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
One of those was a single class tournament, right?
The first one.
Then they went into the first of the two class, the 1A and 2A. You told me an interesting story about a great basketball player from the past who I've always followed too, Jack Sikma. Tell me about that.
Well, in 1973, Jack Sikma's team was at the small school state tournament, and I drew that assignment. Mr. Astroth assigned me and another guy to that game, and my first whistle, stepping onto that court at the University of Illinois, is kind of intimidating, especially if you've never been on it before, and I was hoping that I'd be able to blow the whistle, but
yeah.
They got the tip, and down comes Sikma's team, and Sikma takes the ball on the baseline and just drills a kid and runs right over the top of him. And I have a foul on him, a personal foul on him, a charging foul. And from that point on, everything went very smoothly. I know Sikma's team won the game because I think maybe they might have won. I don't know if they won the championship or not, but at any rate, that was my first
Your
call
first whistle on a former or eventual NBA player. That's terrific.
That's right.
Jack had a great career with Seattle Supersonics, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
That's true. The interesting thing, you talk about the intimidation of the first time stepping on the court at Assembly Hall. I miss the fact that it's not there anymore. It was an incredible experience for any high school kid to be part of that.
It certainly was.
And Peoria, they run the tournament well. And the IHSA has done a great job, but the Civic Center in Peoria is just not the Assembly Hall.
That's right. It's newer,
it's nicer, it's got more amenities, but it's not the Assembly Hall. And, of course, the Assembly Hall, after becoming State Farm Center and all the things they've done to make it nicer, I guess it is as nice or better than the Peoria Civic Center now.
It is quite a place up there.
When you did, once you were doing that level of high school basketball, I assume by that point you were certified, you were all the way to the top of those
you
three.
You had to be, yeah, to work,
to work those. How did you get into doing collegiate? Because you started doing junior college games, but eventually it turned into Plains and working with Ed Hightower and Big Ten and Big Eight and a lot of neat stuff and a lot of time on TV.
Well, after I worked my last game in 75, I received a call from a guy out of Decatur by the name of Jerry Menz, who was a Big Ten basketball referee and a Big Eight basketball referee. And Jerry said, well, now you're done with the high school. You can't do that anymore. I will take you to some games, and we'll work some small college games together. And I said, well, I have to check with my principal for that. And so I checked with the principal, and I said, here's my offer. What do I do? And he said, Mr. Grissom, he said, I don't care where you are after 4 and before 8 the next morning, but I know where you're going to be between 8 and 4. And I said, you're saying that I would not be able to get any substitute to take my place when I'm off. And he said, that's correct. So I called Jerry back and said, Jerry, I can't do it. So I just waited until an opportunity came that for me to leave teaching, and that didn't run me out of teaching, but a better opportunity for higher pay came from NEFCO Scoreboard Company. And when I took that, the first call I made was to Jerry Menz, and the rest is history.
Yeah. Rod Grissom is our guest, talking about high school officiating, moving on into junior college and to the big time. We'll have more with Ron right after these messages. Back on the radio with Ron Grissom, officiate of the basketball referee who has from Greenville, who's had quite an interesting story all the way through. So you come after 26 years of teaching and you say, I've got an opportunity to do some big-time basketball, make some good money, and they're telling me I can't not because I got to be at school. So how do we solve that problem?
Well, I had a good friend that I had become acquainted with him at Greenville. His name was Jan Nevinger, and he owned his father, and he owned NEFCO Scoreboard Company. And Jan asked me if I'd like to work for him. And I said, it depends on where, because I have a family. And he said, Indiana. And I said, yes. I didn't even think twice because Indiana is a great sports state, a great basketball state. They had just had a great consolidation of all their schools within the state, and there were new schools and old scoreboards put in them. They moved the old ones from the old schools and left the old schools standing, but anyway, the scoreboards went there. And so I had relatives that told me Indiana is a great place for that, and so I accepted the position, and I had all the state of Indiana as a territory, and it was just a great time to move on the scoreboard business.
And you were still able to live in Greenville.
I was.
That you got a chance to drive, travel out through the week and get home on a weekend.
I drove 2 hours to my territory, to get into my territory every Monday morning.
That's a great life if you can handle it. I know. I've done it. But it is, now when you were going to all these high schools and you walk in and you talk to athletic directors, obviously first, by being able to walk in and say, I'm a basketball official, I know about which I speak, and the NEVCO name was certainly preceded you with their reputation, you probably didn't have too much trouble getting indoors and talking to people, did you?
Not at all. And when they found out I was working in the Big Ten Conference, then the doors were all graciously opened.
Yeah, I can believe that. By the way, do you have your scoreboards at Assembly Center in Bloomington?
No. Assembly Hall had Fair Play scoreboards, and I put a bid in on them and was allowed to do that. And before that, the Fair Play had there weren't any other bids allowed at that time. But they did allow me to put in a bid, and Fair Play got the bid anyway. So that's
now,
fine.
When you do a scoreboard for a big university facility, with all the ribbon boards and all the different things and the video displays, does that include literally a year or two's worth of training and a employee who knows how to run it that comes along with it? Because that's a big, big deal.
It would on the ones with the message centers and all of that. And in the major arenas like the great big coliseums and so forth in the major cities, there is a person that is assigned there by that company, and he just maintains that scoreboard, keeping it going. We didn't ever do it because until after I retired, we didn't get into message centers.
Yeah.
And so then the message center is the thing that causes the problems. The scoreboards are foolproof.
Yeah.
There's not much to them, and they run well.
Yeah, and the message centers, when you constantly are updating in real time,
that's
when it requires somebody who really knows what they're doing.
It does.
Interestingly enough, working in Indiana, which, of course, right alongside Illinois, is the basketball breadbasket of this nation. Other states may claim, you know, California and New York think they're so great. We know better, don't we? We know that right here is basketball. Illinois, the home of the original March Madness.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what the NCAA says, Illinois basketball is March Madness. Who was the guy? Terry always talks about him. The guy who wrote the poem that was first said many, many years ago. And, you know, it was the March Madness poem. And that one shining moment's not as good as what that poem was. But anyway, don't mean to digress. I just get really, really wound up when somebody else claims March Madness because they're not. This is it here. When you got that call to become affiliated with the larger schools and the conferences, what all was involved? Because obviously, you were working for NEVCO, and now the opportunity came to go there. How did that come about?
Now, are you asking how did we go?
How did you get the opportunity to do the Big 8, the Big 10, get into there?
Camps are a big thing now. And
for officials.
For officials, yes. And in order for an official today to go move from high school to JUCO to the majors, he would need to go to several camps. I went to one, and it was a three-day camp, and I spent 2 days there because I had an appointment at Indiana that I had to take care of in the middle of the three-day camp.
In St. Louis.
In St. Louis. And there was supervisors there from the Big 8 Conference, And the Big 8 conference supervisor was also the Missouri Valley Conference. And so he watched me work the first day, and I thought having to take off would kill me being gone on the second day. But I came back the third day and worked. And at the end of the camp, they all got together, and about a week later, I received a letter from Johnny Overby who had the Big 8 and the Missouri Valley, that I had been accepted as an official for the following fall in the Big 8 conference. And so he sent me a contract. I signed the contract, and from that point on then, you attend a lot of meetings, and they tell you how they want it done, and if you do it right, you get to stay. If you don't, you're gone.
Now, when you started doing Big 8 and Big 10 games, we talked a little bit about the money at the start. How did your life change then, both in terms of travel and income-wise? What occurred once you got into that level?
Well, of course, if the game is within 150 miles in the Big Ten, if it's just over 150 miles, you get paid for flying, your airline ticket. Plus, at that time, my game fee was $550 for the game, and it was also, there was a $125 per diem. So, and they put all that in the check to you, and they pay you once a month. So you may work 8 or 10 games or more in a month, and then all at once you get a big check. But they put all everything together, and they never made a mistake. But I flew small aircraft a lot out of Litchfield Airport and some out of Greenville Airport to the games when I could get a single-engine aircraft. And that was a lot cheaper. And it also let me stay at home until mid-morning of the day of the game.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So I was home and could be working on NEVCO stuff much more than I could have if I'd had to go down and wait in the airport at St. Louis for all my airplanes.
Jeff Wade fly you to a few games?
Jeff Wade did.
That's what I figured.
He did. Bob Alexander was a guy from north of Greenville that was a mail carrier, and he was checked out as far as jets were concerned, but we didn't have any jets handy, and I couldn't afford one anyway. But we flew twin engine planes quite a lot. But everybody said you're crazy in the mid-America in the wintertime. You should never fly a single engine or a fixed engine airplane, small aircraft, because they catch ice and it puts them in the ground.
Yeah.
But never had a problem, and so I lucked out.
Well, good. I'm glad that worked out okay. Did you get to fly with the team on certain occasions?
With the team?
Yeah. Never could do that?
No, you don't do that.
Not like announcers who get a ride with the team and get a hitch on, huh?
And if you have a afternoon game, you have to go into town the day before.
Just to make sure you're there.
That's right. If you have a night game, you have to be in town. I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was 5 hours before. So it took all day to do a night game.
Sure. What, when you're doing this, now you did the Big 8, you did the Big 10, then you got into doing Big 8 conference tournaments, and then you did the first Big 10 conference tournament, and that was your final year of officiating.
Yes.
Did you notice a difference between the way the Big 8 conference was being run, the tournaments being run, versus that first year of the Big 10? Because the Big 10, of course, for all those years, held out, didn't have a tournament, because they would always get several teams in. Then they decided to go to a tournament to make more money. It made more sense. And United Center wanted the tournament, I guess, probably. So what was the difference between, say, Big 8 and Big 10? Can you differentiate between the conferences, how they operate?
The Big 10 paid more.
Okay, there you go.
That was number one. The Big 10 at that time seemed to be a little more professional, and I don't mean that the Big 8 wasn't professional. I just mean that they had you on conference calls. They were always sending you reminders and points of emphasis, they call it, what they wanted called and what they, and that was a point of emphasis and how they wanted it called. And Rich Falk was our supervisor, and he was the greatest supervisor ever as far as I'm concerned, because he had been a basketball coach at Northwestern, and he knew how a basketball program should be run and how he wanted the officiating teams run and assignments made and so on. And I can't say enough, give him enough glowing accolades, because he's just an amazing man.
Now, you got a chance. I have so many more questions I want to get in. I want to make sure that I get them here, because we're maybe half done with questions. You had the opportunity to work with two guys that the names, if I mention them, not only you and I, but a lot of people are going to know. One, of course, Ed Hightower, who was your partner in the Big Ten and Big Eight for a long time. Also, Ed Bain from Decatur, who was certainly one of the dean of the officials, along with you and Ed and a number of others. You did this for a long time, so you got to be known. You had a lot of television exposure. They always mentioned who you were at the start of the games, and you're on a lot of close-ups. So you attain a certain amount of celebrity, also a certain amount of people who say that he's a bum and things like that.
Notoriety.
Yeah, you get notoriety as well as celebrity. But what was it like working with the same guy for the most part, like with Ed, or did you do some with Ed Bain as well?
Jim Bain.
Jim Bain, yes.
Yes, I did.
Okay, I thought that. I thought so.
I worked with both.
And you always worked a two-man team. You never worked a three-man team, right?
No, we always worked three from my, after my first year, we worked three-man in all the.
You were doing three.
Yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure when that came about.
Yeah.
What did that do? How did that change the way the games were called from going from two-man to three-man?
Well, there was a lot better floor coverage, and we had classes, actually walking classes on the floor with players in the fall before the programs started their games, and we would go to those, and we would officiate games, and there would be observers there. Telling us what we did wrong and what we didn't do wrong, how to switch, when one guy calls the foul, where does he go from that point, so that everybody was rotating, the crew was rotating. And it got to be where everybody knew what to do, and so it was a pretty short learning process, but it was much, much better officiated game when they went to three.
I understand. Now, second question that I would be in trouble if I didn't ask from Terry. This was one he wanted me to make sure I asked you. And it's a good question. You can't call everything. How do you keep things under control? How do you know when to call that charging foul, when to let them play? And, you know, the Big Ten has their reputation as a let-them-play school. There are certain conferences that don't have that reputation. How were you ever given advice on how to do it?
They would always, and this comes from the supervisor of officials, in order to stay in the league, you have to be able to determine advantage, disadvantage. So when a player got an advantage over a person, it was a foul over an opponent. When a player didn't have an advantage over that, if he put that player at a disadvantage, there was a foul. But you had to learn what advantage, disadvantage was. And in high school ball, you don't do that because the kids aren't that strong. And you can tell when a man that's 6'8" has been put at a disadvantage, and you can and weighs 300 pounds. And you can tell when a man has been put at a disadvantage when he's 6 foot tall and a guard, and the guards can be put at a disadvantage more so than a big man. And it comes to a fine line, and it's in the eye of the beholder.
It is subjective, yes.
The guy sitting there observing the game, and every Big Ten game was looked at the next day. If it wasn't watched that night live, it was seen the next morning. Because one night I had a technical foul, and I was concerned about the technical foul. And you were supposed to report them anyway, and I called Mr. Falk the next morning, and I said, I had a technical foul last night. He said, yes, I saw the game, and the technical foul was warranted, and the team lost in overtime that the technical foul was on. And he said, I've been getting reports that it was the best game between those two teams that they had seen, and they went head-to-head every year, and best game. He didn't say it was the best officiated game, but he said it was the best game, and he had no thumbs down on anything that we as a crew did.
When we watch games, and it doesn't matter, it could be an 8-point spread in the last minute, it could be a 24-minute spread in the last minute, and as a viewer at home or in the stands, and we're watching foul after foul after foul, does that get as maddening to you as it does to us?
It does, but you know what's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
It's a part
yeah.
of the game, so it has to be dealt with.
Of course, the IHSA solved that with a running clock. So you know
they did.
That, yeah, the last if it gets to a certain point, like 30 points, I think it's 30 points in the last quarter, even any time it goes to a running clock. So that solves that. But of course, you know, here at our radio station, where sports has been such an important part of our programming over the years. We do over 200 high school events a year, not to mention the Illini and Cardinal baseball. So high school sports are something that we talk about a lot. Our listeners talk about a lot. What is there anything that you see in basketball, whether it's college or high school, that you wish would change?
And do you want me to go with the college first?
You can. Or and also a second part, is there something that you're glad they did make the change? So what needs to be and what are you glad they did?
Well, what I'm not glad they're doing in the college level is making the game in the last minute, going to the clock, to the bench all the time, and checking the clock and resetting the clock and so on. And I understand they want to get it right. But we didn't have, when I was officiating, I lived in great fear of causing an end-of-game situation with my whistle, or lack thereof, and causing a team to lose a game. Fortunately, it never happened that I know of. But now, there's no way you can get lazy, I think, as an official. And I'm not saying these today's officials are lazy in the college game, because they're not. They're very good. They're the best that is available. And they are very good. But I think they relax a little bit toward the end of the game because all we have to do is go to the monitor.
Yeah. And that destroys.
We can get it right.
That destroys the flow of the game as badly as all those fouls, too,
yes,
doesn't it?
Does. It does. Now, at the high school level, I don't really know, because I don't attend games, and I don't really know what needs to be done there. They've gone to three officials, but I don't think they can go to the at the end of the game. Well, you said it's a running clock. Now,
yeah.
So. I didn't know that.
We're talking with Ron Grissom, talking about officiating, and it's been a fascinating hour so far. We got more to go. We'll be back with Ron in just 12 minutes in front of 4 o'clock, in for our final segment with Ron Grissom, former official, both high school, college. And, Ron, did you ever consider pursuing, like, the NBA? Was that ever a thought? Did you ever have a conversation about doing that?
I never did. I never thought about it. I wouldn't have wanted it. They always seem to get in too much trouble.
Don't they, though?
Some way.
Yeah.
And the, you know, when they had the deal with the officials getting first-class tickets and then they were cashing them in,
yeah,
and not paying tax on the difference that they took. We had a coach, well, and I'll name that coach, Huggins, that coaches at West Virginia.
Sure.
He was at Cincinnati at that time. And he said, wrote everybody, at least in our league that had him. I worked in that league, too. He said, I just wonder how many major college officials are doing this, too. Ha ha. And so I think he was just being funny, but he was also making a point. But of course we didn't get any first class tickets.
I didn't think so, because they're just a little pricey, you know. But as far as doing you did NCAA Division II, you did NAIA championships as well. Is there any particular aspect of officiating basketball at a certain level that you didn't like? Was it fun? Was it a great experience all the way through?
I loved every minute of every game.
Well, I would think the best part would be going from $750 a game to a check for $4,000 or $5,000 at the end of the month.
It was. I don't know that it was the best part, but the best part, I think, was just finally making it to the major college, and I have to say it was never my goal when I started, but later on it did become a goal. And after I got into the junior college ball, I really liked that, and I thought, well, maybe I can do this. So I was very fortunate to be selected as a major college official.
When you look at the career that you've had and the opportunity, do you feel that there was a certain amount of luck and blessing involved along with your hard work, or did you feel like that you had to scrape and scratch for everything that you did?
No, I had good friends that were great officials that I had known either from playing ball with or fast pitch softball, either with or against them, and from officiating with them in lower, like JUCO tournaments or that sort of thing. So made friends with them, and I never asked them for anything, but they are the ones that suggested that I attempt to make the Division I.
Two final questions. You worked with regular partners a lot. You had guys that you worked with certainly more than once or twice. Do you still get a chance to visit, talk to them once in a while?
I do. Jim Bain just died.
Yes.
Back about a year ago now, I guess. Maybe not quite a year. But Hightower, I'd speak with him probably once a month or once every couple of months.
But you probably pass cross paths once in a while, too, don't
well,
you?
Well, he spends a lot of time in Florida now.
Oh, well, okay.
And he's retired, and he has a house in Florida, and so he goes back and forth, and he's always a busy guy. But I do visit with him, and there's some guys in Ohio that I worked with that I don't see, but talk to.
Final question. I want you to take a few minutes about this, because we got about 6 minutes here. Final question is, everybody who is familiar with watching the game at these levels, whether it's elementary games, junior high, high school, it's hard to find officials. We're running out of them. The officiating crews are getting older, as we all are, you and I in this room, you know. our days of officiating, our days of playing, that they're long gone. They really are. What can be done to get younger people involved?
Well, I would say, first, you have to like basketball. That has to be and you don't have to play basketball. But I was never a good basketball player. I sat on the bench at Ramsey High School, and so, you know, I wasn't very good. But I liked the game, and I wanted to be in it more. So you have to have that desire. You have to love basketball to start it, because there's a lot of ups and downs in getting to officiating, and all your officiating. You have bad nights, you have good nights. But I think money is causing people not to go into the occupation, I guess you would call it, and the expense of gas,
yeah,
being away from your family.
There are so many more things to do than what
there were. That's correct. So if you don't love basketball, you're not going to do it. And so whether maybe you need to, if I was an athletic director, I would look at people that played basketball and try to get them in the game as soon as they graduated from high school. And an athletic director is the guy that can have the main impetus on it, because he's the guy that does the hiring.
Maybe the athletic director should say, we need to recruit or bring about the possibility of having kids in school learn to be officials,
right,
as well as learn to play. And maybe, okay, you're not 6'5", and you can't dribble real well, and your shooting percentage is low. Why don't you look at this game that you love and like to play at a different point of view, be an official?
I worked my first basketball game for Mr. Hawthorne at Ramsey. I was in high school, and he needed a referee, and I said, I can referee that game. And so I refereed his, and it was a little intramural game. But that was the first basketball game I ever worked on. I really liked doing it.
Well, that's good.
So I think it has to kind of stick with you, like maybe playing the game. But money and time, there's a lot of time goes into it. You're gone from home a lot of nights.
And you don't
work 7 games a week when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And that's not 6 games a week.
There's also the same problem, football officials, softball, baseball officials, and now we have girls' sports. We've got more games to cover. But everybody we talk to all talks about the same thing, whether it's Louis Lang, you know, or whether it's you or any official. You just stop at a ball game after he's getting ready to go to the locker room and say, what are we going to do? They all say we need them, but they don't really have the answer. So hopefully something will come that we can get more.
I think it might be able to come down from the athletic directors for them to attempt to have some camps themselves and not charge.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem, charging and finding the time to go to the camp. Have the camps out at night as opposed to during the afternoon. But if you're going to go to a major college camp, you're going to go there and you're going to stay and you're going to be gone 3, 4, 5 days.
Yeah. It has been a pleasure having you. And you've really, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes explaining what your journey has been. It's been a great hour. You've answered every question that I had on my list, so I really appreciate that. Call that a success. And what do you do with yourself these days? You got about a minute.
I live on a place that has a lot of trees, and I'm always trimming trees and picking up limbs in my yard, so I still get to keep exercising.
That sounds like a good thing. Family all good?
Family's fine.
All right. Ron Grissom, our guest, thank you very much for making this hour pretty enjoyable for me and a lot of others.
Thank you for having me.